Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist. I'm back on the air again this week, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick. And today, I want to say something about last week's show, which was on horseshoe crabs. If you didn't listen in, maybe you should, because it was a terrific show. And I spoke about where you can see the horseshoe crabs at this time of year. They come up to breed in the bays and the full moon tides, because the female wants to get her eggs way up onto the beach. So she'll do it during the full moon, new tide, and new moon tide and full moon tide. Okay, so our sponsor today is Fairway Market. And I want to remind you, my talk today is going to be called On the Rocks That We Eat. So some of you may have guessed what they were, because I mentioned it in last week's show. And if you did guess it, well, that's good. Good for you. And if you didn't, I'll tell you what it is. It's salt. And also calcium carbonate, which is a limestone. So there are really two rocks that I'm going to talk about, but mainly I'm going to talk about salt. So you may say, well, salt comes in, you know, you buy it in the supermarket in a box or in a container and put it in my salt shaker and I never think anything else about it. But the salt is very important to us. And why is it important? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about. Okay, right after the break, I'll tell you about some exhibits at the Museum of Natural History. It's going to be vacation time soon for kids. And there are some great exhibits that I think your kids will enjoy at the museum. And there's even something about salt in the museum. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about salt. What is it? And I just told you it comes from rocks. So where are these rocks? And how do we get the salt? And where does salt come from? Okay, so what we're going to do now is salt is a mineral, okay? And it's made up of two things, sodium and... well, who knows what the sodium chloride. So it's made up from chloride, or not chlorine gas, but chloride and sodium. It's essential for animal life in small quantities, but it is harmful to animals and plants in excess. So just the right amount of salt is what we need to live, and I'll talk about that as we talk. And even animals need salt. All animals need salt in their diets. Okay, now if you've ever gone, well, I don't know how many people have gone hunting in my audience. That would be interesting to find out. But many years ago, when people were hunter gatherers, one of the ways that they would find where the game is, they would follow the trails that the animals made to the salt licks. And what were salt licks? Salt licks were natural occurring rock formations that were made of salt. So the animals would go and they would lick the salt lick because they needed salt in their diets also. The carnivores really didn't have to do it, because when you eat meat and other flesh, there's salt in it already, because whatever you ate had been as part of the diet, they have salt in it. So it's mostly the other animals like cows and deer and ruminants, which are animals that chew their cud. Needed salt. So you don't want to eat too much salt. As you all know, there's a big campaign on to prevent people from eating too much salt. So salt has been a main method of preserving foods for a very, very long time. If we go back in history, humans have used canning and artificial refrigeration to preserve food for the last 100 years or so. But salt has been the best known food preservative, especially for fish and meat, for thousands of years. Okay, a very ancient salt works has been discovered in Romania. Now, a salt works is a place where these early folks would go to get the salt. It could have been a salt marsh, it could have been a rock outcrop, and salt was always mined because it was so valuable, because everybody has a need for salt. And it's one of the basic tastes, I would say, that we need. And I think I'll get to that a little further in the talk. So remember that it's a need for humans as well as a need for animals. And so in Romania, there was evidence that they were mining salt. And the way they were doing it was they found there was a spring that had salt water in it. Now, today we wouldn't touch that spring because we want springs with good fresh water. But it was a salt water spring, and they would take the water and they would evaporate the water, and the salt would be left. The salt was extracted, and as far back as we know, about 6,000 years ago, BC around 650, there's evidence that the salt was being extracted, okay? And it had a direct correlation to the rapid growth of this society's population after it started producing salt, because there were a lot of places that didn't have salt or they didn't know where they could find it. So there was a big industry years ago in salt mining and salt operation. And this harvest from salt in a lake in China dates back to at least 6,000 BC. They found early implements that they used, making it one of the oldest verifiable salt works. So salt was included among funeral offerings found in ancient Egyptian tombs. Remember the Egyptians, when they buried their dead, they mummified them, and they left with them jewelry and food because they thought they were going to another place, the other world. So they also left with salted birds and salted fish because they figured these people, wherever they were going, would need some food. So they left food for them. From about 2800 BC, the Egyptians began exporting salt fish to the Phoenicians, who were their neighbors, in return for cedar from Lebanon, because the country of Lebanon has a lot of cedar trees, and they're famous. And the Lebanese were making glass that the Egyptians learned how to make, and a dye called Tyrian purple. And I'll deal with Tyrian purple in another show. It's a very interesting thing where that purple dye comes from. So the Phoenicians traded Egyptian salt fish and salt from North Africa throughout their Mediterranean empire. Also, there were things called salt roads or salt routes. Along the Sahara, the Tuareg people maintained routes especially for the transport of salt by Azalai, which is probably an Arabic word for salt caravans. In 1960, the caravan still transported some 15,000 tons of salt. But this trade has now declined to roughly a third of the figure, because now salt is very easily obtainable, and it's not expensive anymore. But many, many years ago, it was a very prized commodity, because in most places, there was no salt, or they didn't know how to mine it. They didn't know where it was. Okay, so a lot of words have salt in it, and a lot of place names have salt in it. And one of the best examples is a city in Austria called Salzburg, Saltzburg. And there's another one called Hallstatt and Hallinen. They lie on the river, and the name of the river is Salzach in central Austria. Okay, and these three cities, they're all close to each other. So Salzach literally means salt water, and Salzburg, salt city, both taking their name from the Germanic root for salt, which is Salz, S-A-L-Z. And the root Hail, H-A-L, also H-A-L-L, gives us the name Gaul. So the mineral name of salt is halite. So now you can see the derivation of it, which goes way back to the old days in Europe. Okay, so halite is the Roman name for the Celts. Okay, H-A-L-L-E, and that's the root. Okay, and in the Ukraine and in Galicia and Spain, there were places named for salt. Place names for Celtic salt works. We don't really know where all those salt works were, but some of these we know because there have been written records about them. So remember Salzburg, okay? Okay, and Hallstatt gave its name to the Celtic archaeological culture that began mining salt in the area in around 800 BC. Around 400 BC, the Hallstatt Celts, who are therefore mined for salt, that means they dug it up from under the ground, and I'll talk a little later about salt deposits under the ground, and began open pan salt making. That means that they had the salt and they made it into a brine by mixing it with water and letting it dissolve, and then they let that evaporate. And I don't know how well that worked in a climate like Austria, but in many places, which I'll talk about, that's the preferred method about extracting salt for using. So these Celtic communities grew rich, trading salt and salted meats to ancient Greece and ancient Rome in exchange for wine and other luxuries. So these were some of the early trades between countries. If they had a great deposit of salt, they became rich because everybody needed salt. And they would trade it for other things that they didn't have. Okay, so it's widely thought, and this is a big dispute yet, that the Roman army was paid in salt. So some historians say yes, and some historians say no. But I sort of think that they may have been paid in salt, or maybe slaves were bought with salt, because the word salary, which means the pay, you know, for the job that you do, is spelled S-A-L-A-R-Y, and the Italian word for salt is sal, S-A-L. So also the word salad means salted, and it comes from the ancient Roman practice of salting leafy vegetables. So there's a long history of salt. I'll tell you one more now right before the break. Mahatma Gandhi, who was a leader of the folks in India, even before they were independent, he led at least 10,000 people on a march to the sea to collect salt because they were protesting the British. They were going to make their own salt from the sea. It was illegal under British rule as it avoided paying the salt tax. This civil disobedience inspired millions of common people and elevated the Indian independence movement from an elitist struggle, because it was just first the middle class and upper class, to a national struggle. So there's a case where salt played a part in the country of India becoming independent, because the British, who controlled India, wanted the folks to buy salt from them. And they had a tax on salt. And a lot of countries did, because salt was so valuable. It was like in our colonies, the tea tax. Well, there was a salt tax also. So that's an interesting story about Mahatma Gandhi. So I'm going to sign off now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about salt as mentioned in the Bible and other religions. So hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air after a short break. The program is The Naturalist, and the sponsor today is the Fairway Markets. And since I'm talking about salt, and if you want to learn about the culinary uses of salt, you have to listen to my daughter's program called Why We Cook. Chef Erica did a great show on salt, and it's archived. And if you want to learn all about sea salt and all these other salts and what to use it for, go to her site and one of the web, archive programs, and you can hear all about salt used in foods. Okay, I'm going to talk about religion now. In the Hebrew Bible, 35 verses mention salt, the earliest being the story of Lot's wife, who was turned into a pillar of salt when she disobediently looked back at the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's in Genesis 19:26, as the Lord destroyed them. So, if you're a religious person and you believe in the Bible and all that, and these stories may have some basis in fact. I don't really know, but that's up to you to believe in them. But they're great stories. Okay, when King Abimelech destroyed the city of Shechem, he is said to have sown salt on it, probably as a curse on anyone who would re-inhabit it. Well, this idea of sowing salt or salting a place was done by armies many in ancient history, because if you throw salt down on the fields, the crops are not going to grow, because salt will kill vegetables that need fresh water, and salt is very detrimental to crops. So when they say that he threw salt down on it, that's what it probably meant. In the Christian New Testament, 6 verses mention salt. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus referred to his followers as the salt of the earth. The Apostle Paul also encouraged Christians to let your conversation always be full of grace, seasoned with salt. So here's another mention of salt, and we know that salt is a seasoning that we use all the time. Okay, and in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad is reported to have said that salt is the master of your food. God sent down 4 blessings from the sky: fire, water, iron, and salt. Okay, salt is used as the third item, which includes an exorcism of the Celtic consecration that is employed in the consecration of a church. So this is the Kells, or the Celtic area, and salt may be added to water where it is customary in the Roman Catholic rite of holy water. Salt is considered to be a very auspicious substance in Hindu mythology, and it is used in particular religious ceremonies like housewarmings and weddings. In Judaism, it is recommended to have either a salty bread or add salt to the bread if this bread is unsalted when doing the Kiddush for the Sabbath. Okay, for you folks who don't know about that stuff, when Orthodox Jews welcome the Sabbath in, which is on Saturday, and it starts at sundown on Friday, what they traditionally do is they'll have a loaf of bread called a challah, which is a braided bread, looks like it's made of braids, and they'll drink a glass of wine and make a blessing over the wine to welcome the Sabbath. So the tradition is to spread some salt over the bread, or to dip the bread in a little salt when passing the bread around the table after the Kiddush. So what they do is, after they drink the cup of wine and welcome the Sabbath, the bread is cut up and passed around to everybody at the table, and you're supposed to have it with a little salt. That's to preserve the covenant between their people and God. Jews dip the Sabbath bread in salt. In Wicca, which is ancient witches, I guess you'd call it, or heathen religion, salt is a symbol of the element earth. It is also used as a purifier of sacred spaces. In native Japanese religion, Shinto, salt is used for ritual purification of locations and people. So if there's a place that people are going to assemble, years ago they would scatter salt around to purify the place. In Aztec mythology, now here's a tough name, Quetzalcoatl was a fertility goddess who presided over salt and salt water. The ancient Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans invoked their gods with offerings of salt and water. Some think that this is the origin of holy water in the Christian faith. So here we see salt mentioned in a lot of places and a lot of uses and all that. Now, when we think of salt, we think of salt in the salt shaker. But salt has a lot of industrial uses besides that. And the most common one that we know about is, especially if you live in cities or even in rural areas, in the wintertime, they used to put salt on the roads. And the question is, why would they salt the roads? So salt is used for snow removal to make it easy to travel and safer. And salt and other chloride-based chemicals reduce snow and ice from road surfaces and sidewalks by lowering the freezing temperature of water. So if you if it's hailing or snowing and you sprinkle salt on the surface, it'll prevent the water from freezing into ice, because it lowers the freezing temperature of water and prevents it from forming ice. So that's a use that's now being phased out, because salt is very harmful to the environment, because the runoff from the salt on the roads will get in maybe into the water and ruin the water, or if it runs off onto vegetation, as I said, salt will kill vegetation. So they're experimenting now with using an extract from beets, believe it or not, which works similar to salt. So they'll make a compound using some salt and some beets and even sand to prevent the roads from freezing up. Okay, so that's one of the, you might say, industrial uses of it. And there's many more that we'll get into in a minute. And first I'll talk about unrefined salt, sea salt, halite, and fleur de sel, which is a French salt. And I only have a minute left in this section. So I'll just say that different natural salts have different mineralities, giving each one a unique flavor. Fleur de sel, a natural sea salt harvested by hand, has a unique flavor varying from region to region. Now, if you go to a gourmet market, you can buy fleur de sel, which means flour of salt. And completely raw salt is bitter because of magnesium and calcium compounds, and thus it's rarely eaten. But I'll talk about what we call gourmet salt or sea salt when I come back. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with the Naturalist Show, and today we're talking about salt, because all of us need salt in our diets, but remember, not too much, because then you're going to have trouble with high blood pressure. Some people are sensitive to salt. It depends on your racial background and even cultural things. So I was talking about unrefined salt, which is salt as it comes from the sea. It's called sea salt or halite, which is the name of the mineral salt. And I mentioned fleur de sel, which is a sort of a gourmet salt that comes from France. Okay, so a refined salt, which is the most widely used salt presently, is mainly sodium chloride. Now, let me just say something about sodium and chloride. Sodium is a very dangerous, it's a metal. It's a very, very dangerous metal. You can't expose it to the air. It has to be kept in an oil-based solution, because if sodium comes in contact with water, it could catch fire and burn. So it's an amazingly dangerous substance. So that's partly what salt is made out of. The other thing that salt is made out of is chloride or chlorine. And chlorine, as we know, is a poisonous gas. It's also used as a disinfectant. If you go in a swimming pool, there's chlorine in the water to kill the bacteria and other critters. And you could smell it if there's too much in the pool. It has a certain smell. You know that chlorine is in the water. But when these two substances are combined together to make sodium chloride or salt, it's harmless, except if you eat too much of it. Okay, so food-grade salt only accounts for a small part of salt production in industrial countries, maybe 3% in Europe and maybe, you know, not much higher in the United States. The majority of salt is sold for industrial use. As I said, for desalting, for use on highways and streets to prevent the rain from freezing or the sleet from freezing. Salt has great commercial value because it's a necessary ingredient in the manufacturing of many things. A few common examples include the production of pulp and paper, setting dyes in textiles and fabrics, and the making of soaps and detergents. And also bathing additives. You've heard of bath salts and in cosmetic products. Okay, so bath salts use sea salt as a main ingredient and combine it with other ingredients. Now, if you want to go for, if you ever go to Israel and you go to the Dead Sea, which has a very, 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 very high salinity content, and the salt has such a high salinity content that you can float there. You can't sink because the water is so dense that you just can't sink. But around the Salt Sea is all this mud that has a lot of mineral deposits, and they have a spa there and in other places too that uses salts from the Dead Sea. Just mention that. Okay, so the manufacture of salt is one of the oldest chemical industries. Salt can be obtained by evaporation of seawater. Now, last year I was in the African country of Namibia, which is a very dry desert climate country. And we flew over the sand dunes because Namibia is famous for its absolutely beautiful sand dunes. If you get a chance to go to Africa, you should save a short time to go through Namibia because the sand dunes are beautiful. They're two-colored sand dunes. When the wind blows from the desert, it blows red sand. And when the wind blows from the sea, it blows gray sand. So as you fly over these dunes, they are two-colored dunes, and they're really beautiful. So we took a small plane to fly over it. And as part of the voyage, we passed over the salt works. And the way the Namibians harvest salt is the way it's been done for thousands and thousands of years. Now remember, Namibia is a very dry climate. Maybe the humidity level there may be 8% or lower. So it's a great place to dry things. So what they do is they built these huge bays. They let the seawater in, then they'll close off the bay, and then just let the seawater evaporate. And it's a great way to do it because you don't have to use any fuel to evaporate the water. And that's the salt works. And that was done, in ancient Egypt, they did it that way, and many other places. And you could still see that being done in parts of the world. Okay? So, as I said, it's an old process. How about here in New York? Where do we get our salt from? Well, we get our salt from salt mines. And where are these salt mines? The salt mines are upstate New York. We have one of the largest deposit of salt around, okay? And it's near the Finger Lakes, near the city of Syracuse, and going west to the Pennsylvania border. The salt mines there, the salt deposit, which is under the ground, is 10,000 square miles, they estimate, of salt. So there's enough salt in New York State to satisfy our needs for a very long time, even if you like very salty food. So the salt is down under the ground from 500 feet down to about 10,000 feet down. And where did that salt, how did it get in the ground? How did it get there? Well, salt originally comes from the oceans, the seas. So when the early earth, when the oceans were being formed, salt from the land ran off into the seas, and the seas became the repository of salt. So the ocean water is 36% salt. So that means if you took, let's say, 1,000 gallon of salt water, a gallon jugs like you can buy milk in, and you evaporated all the water from it, you would be left with 36 containers of salt. So there's quite a bit of salt in the ocean. And a little later we'll talk about our salt in our bodies. But right now let's get back to salt mining. So how do they mine salt? Well, it's considered hard rock mining salt because it's a solid rock. So what do they have to do? They have to drill holes like for coal and blast it out of the wall, and then they scoop it up with steam shovels or whatever you call those things, like Caterpillar tractors, and they'll put it in a little train that'll take it to the surface, and then they'll process the salt. And that salt is used for industry, but if it's used for human consumption, then what they'll do is they'll make the salt into a brine by using water, and then they'll let it recrystallize out. And that leaves out all the impurities when it recrystallizes, and you just get pure sodium chloride or pretty pure salt. So what they do is when they blast the salt rocks out of the wall, they'll bring it to the surface and crush it up and use it for industrial purposes. Or, as I said, they'll make it into a brine. So what they do is they pump water down into the sections of the mine, and the water will dissolve the salt crystals, and then they'll pump it out and refine it again. So, by the way, I forgot last week to tell you to look at the photo gallery where I put up pictures of horseshoe crabs, because last week's talk was on the horseshoe crab. And for this talk, if you go to the photo gallery, you'll see a picture of a huge piece of rock crystal salt from upstate New York. Now, I asked somebody to just point at it when I took the photograph. So a young lady is pointing with her finger to this huge hunk of salt. Now, that hunk of salt probably weighs, I would say, easily 500-600 pounds. And you could see how big it is. It's about 4 feet tall, and the circumference is probably 3 feet around. And that came from a salt mine in upstate New York that I've just been talking about. So if you ever get to the Museum of Natural History, my favorite museum, go to the Hall of the Planet Earth, and you'll see this huge piece of salt next to a huge piece of another mineral where gold is being extracted from, and a huge piece of coal. Because if you heard my talk on the Earth, I said one of the reasons the Earth is habitable is because the Earth recycles everything. So here's a case of we recycling a substance, salt. Now, the salt originally was laid down by sea animals. Okay, I said that salt ran off the land, but also, the sea animals didn't have a lot to do with it. That's part of my other show when I talk about the other edible rock, which is limestone. But let's get back to salt right now. Okay, so we spoke about salt being mined all over the place, and the price of salt kept coming down through history as they discovered more and more salt deposits. Okay, and I told you about Mahatma Gandhi, and I told you about its use in religion, and unrefined salt is a sea salt, and the refined salt is what we use for table salt. Okay, so let's see. Table salt is refined salt, which contains about 97 to 99% sodium chloride, and it usually contains a substance in it that makes it free-flowing. You know, if you have salt in a salt shaker and you have a lot of damp weather, the humidity or the water vapor in the air will get into the salt and cake it up, and it won't come out very easily. So what the commercial companies do is they'll put in an anti-caking agent like sodium siloaluminate or magnesium carbonate, and that helps the salt to flow. So if you have salt stored for a long time in a box and it's clunky and lumpy, well, when you put it into your salt shaker, what you can do is you just can shake it up and break it up. And some people also add their own desiccant. A desiccant is a substance that will absorb moisture from the air, such as a few grains of uncooked rice. So I remember my mother used to do that, because we spent many summers out at the seashore, and the water and the air was always humid, so she would put salt in the salt shakers to absorb the moisture into the rice. So that really works, and it helps to break up the clumps when the chemicals that they put in are not enough. Okay, so what about salt? Is it used all over the world? Well, practically, yes. But in many East Asian cultures, salt is not traditionally used as a condiment. We use it as a condiment. It's on the table. We shake it in our food and put it in cooking. However, condiments such as soy sauce, fish sauce, and oyster sauce tend to have a very high salt content and fill much the same role as salt, providing as a table condiment that we use in salt shakers. Okay, so there are different kinds of salts. There's the raw salt, sea salt, and refined salt that we use to eat with. And I said things are added to the salt to prevent it from caking up. And also there's a salt that most of us buy called iodized salt. Now, what's iodized salt? That's salt that iodine has been added to it. Now, why would they want to put iodine in salt? Okay, iodized salt is table salt mixed with a minute amount of potassium iodide, or a different iodine. Iodized salt is used to help reduce the incidence of iodine deficiency in humans. We need a little drop of iodine in our diet. And if we don't get it, then you can get goiter, which is a gland in your neck swells up. But most of us buy iodized salt. And that and the iodized salt is used by almost everybody, unless you buy kosher salt. Now, I'll talk about kosher salt in a minute. And is it different than regular salt? Well, not really. Kosher salt doesn't have any iodine in it because it has to be a pure salt. So so if you're going to use kosher salt in cooking, then you should use some regular salt at your table to get the iodine in it. Okay? And why is it called kosher salt? Not that it's necessarily kosher, which means that it's made according to strict Jewish regulations. It's used in the koshering of meat. Jews are not supposed to eat meat, the blood of animals. So when the animal is slaughtered, the blood is drained out. But sometimes there's still blood in it. So an Orthodox Jewish woman will take the meat and put it on the tray and salt it. And the salt will draw the blood out of the meat, which will fulfill the requirement of not eating blood. So that's why it's called kosher salt. Now it's used a lot. Chefs use it a lot because it's a great grain size, the salt, or the corn size, as it's called. You know, corned beef? Corned beef wasn't made with corn. It was made with salt. And the salt grains were called corn because they were big grains. So that's what kosher salt is, if you always wondered what it is. So we're going to sign off in a minute. But before we do, I'm going to talk about, I mentioned the rock and the Museum of Natural History. And also, I know that vacation time is coming up and that I'm going to tell you in a minute or two some other exhibits that are very nice at the museum and that you should take your kids to see. But my time is up for this segment. And remember that when you salt your food, it's one of the basic flavors that we crave. I think it's salt, sweet, two other ones which I can't think of right now. But salt is an essential ingredient, and salt comes from the sea, as I said. And we have this huge rock formation upstate New York, so we'll never run out of salt. And in many other countries, there's plenty of salt now. So it used to be a really, really valuable commodity. But these days, salt is very inexpensive. Okay, so I have more information about salt, but I'm going to stop for a minute because Jack is giving me a signal that I think I have about 30 seconds left. And when we come back, we'll talk some more about salt.